I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. We hear a lot these days about how to make Kansas City more walkable and bicycle friendly. Today we'll find out about the urbanist organization Better Block KC, an activist group that lets people experience what those changes might look and feel like in the real physical world. But first, the push for safe spaces and trigger warnings is an issue that many professors have to deal with, sometimes dramatically. We'll find out how one homegrown play is providing some thoughtful commentary on the millennial revolution. Later, Brian McTavish returns with the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Trace the history of theater back to the Greeks, and you'll find that it wasn't the comedies that came first, but the tragedies, plays that look at the serious questions of life. For 2,500 years, playwrights have continued to produce dramatic works that explore the perpetual conflicts of humankind, often reflected in the current issues of the day. That tradition continues in an original work debuting tonight at the Living Room Theater. Trigger Happy explores the issues arising out of the debate over trigger warnings, those statements alerting an audience to potentially distressing material. Here to discuss Trigger Happy are two featured actors and the playwright. For over 25 years, Scott Cordes is among that group of artists who's made Kansas City his professional home as both an actor and a director. And Scott, nice to have you. Good morning.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Steve.
Mark Robbins is also here. He can also be counted on as a longtime artistic presence in the local scene, working as an actor, director, and producer of theater in the Kansas City area for over 30 years. Nice to have you, Mark.
Thanks a lot.
And Ron Simonian is a resident playwright in the Living Room Theater. To give you an idea of how long he's been at this, his first play was produced here in Kansas City back in 1992. And Ron, nice to have you.
Yeah, great to be here.
Ron, let's get it straight from the horse's mouth here. Give us a synopsis of this play and what you had in mind.
Well, this play was basically written to kind of stimulate conversation because I had noticed that in the world today, especially in academia, there was this divide where it was, if they disagreed with you, they wanted to shut you up. There were protests, silencing people. If a speaker was called in, they tried to get him disinvited. There were riots, and no one was communicating. And then I also noticed in theater, it's a very liberal art form, to say the least, and you rarely find a conservative voice in American theater. And so my goal with this was to put a very strong conservative voice mixed with a very strong liberal voice and find a way to contain them to present the arguments on both sides of this fence as clearly as possible. And it covers a wide range of the topics that we're dealing with today and the political correctness, the safe rooms, to Black Lives Matter, to the trigger warnings that you mentioned, transgender issues. And it tried to put this piece together to hit all of those and give people maybe a dialogue that they can start rather than closing each other off.
Was there a certain incident, something that sparked you to set you down this path?
Well, I mean, I, for one, have had some plays that have kind of labeled me. I've been called anything from a misogynist to a pig to whatever you could. I mean, I've had some, you know, pretty
misogynist pig.
Sometimes that one as well. But basically, I've always just tried to tell stories. And I found that as the First Amendment is like the most important thing to a playwright, I'm sure is to you in journalism.
Absolutely.
As well. And I see it being destroyed. And if people would let someone kind of explain their point of view, you can learn from them or you can change their mind. But if you shut the curtain on them and just ignore it and surround yourself with like-minded people, you really get nowhere, but violence escalates from that because people just feel like their whole lives are being attacked rather than an open dialogue.
Well, Scott and Mark, who's the liberal and who's the conservative in this play?
Well, I guess I'm considered the liberal.
Okay.
But I catch myself sometimes agreeing with Mark's character as much.
Yeah. What was your first impression, Scott, when you saw the script? What hit you about it?
I thought it was ripped from the headlines. It just, It's what people are talking about on college campuses everywhere. Everybody says that the freedom of speech on college campuses, you know, is missing in action. It's just, you know, comedians, Jerry Seinfeld, Chris Rock, they don't want to play colleges anymore because they're just too politically correct.
Mm-hmm. Mark, how about you? What caught you about it?
Well, the fact that it, the fact that it was very contemporary. It was very today. And but also the fact that it is so wide ranging, and it's just it's great to have a two hander like this, a two person play, because it really boils it down to a dialectic, a real discussion, you know, and fight also a heated discussion, passionate discussion.
Well, Mark, your characters are friends as well as co-workers in this production. You've known each other professionally for years as well. You've worked together many times. How did that help you in your roles, or how did that play out?
Well, it just makes the story more interesting. It gives it a twist. I mean, as Ron said, he covers a lot of ground, and that's one of the things that keeps it from being a sort of a staid dialectic, you know, just a back and forth. I mean, it's the fact that these people are invested in each other as well as in their own points of view, and they. You know, they don't want to break up. They want to maintain the friendship even while maintaining these very opposing points of view.
Yeah, back in the day, they used to have Thursday debate nights in college, you know, and they would pick a subject and they just would go at it because they're friends and they would love to argue. They love to argue with each other.
But over the course of the years, that relationship, I mean, those sorts of arguments have become fewer and more far between. And when they do happen, they seem to be more...
Hateful.
Reflecting what's going on in our times right now. I mean, Sky, did you get the role that you wanted as the liberal in this production?
I was a little surprised that I was cast at this role. I thought I'd be cast in the other role.
Why?
I don't know. When I first read it, I just figured that, well, I'm kind of mouthy in real life, and that, that character was a little bit more mouthy. So,
yeah.
But I'm really glad I got this. Now it makes me expand. It makes me, you know, I love it. It's a good role.
Are you the natural conservative in this thing, Mark?
No, me?
Yeah.
Oh no. I'm hard left.
So you're out of type here. You're out of character.
Right.
You're doing
but
this
that's
thing.
That's nothing new in the theater. You know, I mean, yeah. I'm it's one of the greatest things to do is to play a really kind of horrible character. It allows you to find bits of yourself and express bits of yourself that you don't normally get to express in real life. You know, Richard III is a blast to play.
Mm-hmm. Did you cast him, Ron?
I had hoped for this cast.
Did you?
Yeah. Rusty Sneary actually did the work. I put my two cents in, and these two guys.
It's, that's the director of the play, right?
Yeah. And an artistic director at the Living Room. And this is a perfect cast. And we both worked, I've worked with both of these guys. They've directed my plays before individually and been in them. So it was really kind of a great experience for me to have them both together.
Yeah. So, Mark, describe your role, your character for us and who that person is.
Jerry is I'm assuming an English teacher in the English department at a university, at a nameless university. And he's been at this university for about 8 years He grew up with the guy who just was appointed to the position of chair of the English department. I think he sees his career going sort of nowhere. Mm-hmm. He's sort of stuck in a rut. But he sees his friend come in, succeed him, achieve what he wanted to achieve with his life goals. I don't know that Jerry has many life goals at this point. He's just maintaining, and he feels that he's surrounded in this university by a growing contingent of like-minded people of hard left. Well, I don't want to say, I can't say the word.
But he feels isolated.
Something that Donald Trump might have clutched at one point.
Yes.
He feels increasingly isolated.
Yeah. Scott, describe your character and the man that you play. What's he like?
Yeah, his name is Frank, and he's the department chair of an English department. And he just feels that he needs to make the education, it needs to be a pleasant experience. He wants to bring his students all together and make them feel safe. Mm-hmm. It's all about creating a safe environment for the students to be educated.
Does he go overboard in that sense?
Well, he doesn't think so.
Yeah.
I think maybe deep down inside he might think so. Mm-hmm. But it's the world out there today. It's just so politically correct. Mm. And everything's on the table, and yet he has to rein back his friend because his friend is just becoming hate-filled lately.
Mm-hmm. Huh. This is KCUR's Up to Date. I'm talking with the cast and playwright of Trigger Happy that runs at the Living Room Theater Wednesdays through Sundays from now until April 16th. For more information, go to livingroomkc.com. Now, Ron, you said that the theater is not doing the job of showing both sides of an issue. And I'm wondering, why should it? If the playwright, you know, has a particular point of view, why should he or she have to offer an alternative angle?
Right. Oh, that's a great question. As a writer, you would like to have an engaging piece. You want people to talk about your show when it's done. I've always felt if people watch a play of mine and they're driving home talking about dinner, I failed. I want them to be discussing this play as they live. I don't answer questions in any of my plays. I try to put the questions out there and let people see where things go. But playwrights shouldn't have to do anything. The problem I have with playwrights in today's society is they are doing one thing and one thing only. It's a very liberal art form. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to have something and you want to call it a political, you know, a political play, and you show one side, there's a famous play called Keeley and Due. It was about the abortion debate years ago. And they claimed it was the most thought-provoking play of both sides represented well. And the play starts out with this conservative group kidnapping this woman and tying her to a bed in the basement so she would have her baby. That's how the play starts. Mm. So we're already kind of starting with the conservative viewpoint being at a disadvantage as far as being reasonable. Do you know what I mean? It's like it's always presented with an agenda. And I think as a writer...
And what's the problem with that? Yeah.
Well, the problem is if you're writing a play that you want to call politically motivated and trying to help people change their minds and give them an experience where they can have debate and discussion, that would be a problem. If you're just trying to do a preach play, well, that's fine. Do whatever you want to do. The problem I see is that we're only getting the preach plays. Mm-hmm. We only get agenda-driven plays when it comes to politics. And I'll tell you what, you lose half your audience.
Is it harder to write a play that just raises questions as opposed to coming down firmly on one side
Absolutely.
Or the other?
Because you can't let your instincts and how you feel. It's like, I mean, I'm not a hardcore conservative, but I told one of the people from the rep, I felt like I was going to throw up half the time I was writing this play. Every other line kind of drove me crazy. Mm-hmm. Then I felt guilty for writing some of this stuff down. But I researched. I went to college newspapers across the country, saw what these arguments were. I went online. I saw people like Ben Shapiro and Yiannopoulos, these different speakers, and some of the points they made were brilliant. And this is the thing that got me was, you have brilliant people like in the Senate, brilliant Republicans, brilliant Democrats, and yet they disagree. Why do we have to say that one group of them is stupid? Mm-hmm. They're not. Yeah. They just disagree.
Yeah.
And in this play, we deal with the issue of debate encouraging the interaction between people.
You know, Scott, free speech, as we're talking here, is that issue here in Trigger Happy. How has doing this play reshaped your thinking on that, or has it? What have you noticed?
Well, I considered myself to be liberal, but while doing this play, some of the arguments that Mark's character has, I have to agree with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know where I stand. That's what's great about this particular piece is that I keep agreeing with both characters, mm-hmm. even though you would think you wouldn't, mm-hmm. because I tend to lean to the left.
Yeah. Mark, how about you?
It hasn't really changed my attitude at all, I must say. But it's interesting. What it has done is educated me as to one way of thinking. I mean, my character, everyone agrees that free speech is a sacred right and it is something to be cherished. However, there's a tendency when defending your own point of view to use it as a convenient tool, mm-hmm. and perhaps just a reactionary tool, you know, without thinking. It's just a knee-jerk response, well, free speech.
Mm-hmm.
I hear that a lot, and I think my character is guilty of it at times, and I hope people pick that up, that that's not something that one ought to do.
Does the issue itself in a play like this become something of another character in and of itself in a play like this? What do you notice, Scott?
Yes, I would say so. It's once you go on the ride, It's hard to get off. It's just really a piece that, with two people doing it especially, going back and forth, and the fact that they're old friends, and that that they want to understand each other, but yet they have their own particular agenda, and sometimes that can, you have to have debate. I think that's what this play is so great about. Just it creates debate.
If I could throw in, the thing that gets me is when it turns into hate speech. That is now the term for speech that I disagree with. Not that it is necessarily hateful, but it's anything I disagree with. If you disagree with me, you're hateful and you're a phobe of some kind, you know, xenophobe, whatever it's going to be. And when we start labeling this way, that's when we have these crises occur of a lack of communication.
Yeah, I notice that as a journalist a lot. You write a piece that someone disagrees with, and you're automatically then designed to be a conservative or a liberal, depending on what the person's point of view is. And you're like, well, that wasn't my intention at all here.
Right. It's like, why are you promoting hate?
Yeah.
And what I've always felt is the First Amendment protected the speech I didn't agree with more than the speech I did agree with.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it's truly there for. And this attitudes change every, look at this, the college kids in the 60s were the ones promoting the free speech. Now the college kids today are being taught by the children of those kids, and they're being taught right now there is no such thing as free speech. You have hate speech. We need a safe room. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of them have valid points, but like Scott said, if he's feeling a little bit of interest in both sides, so to speak, it's a matter of hearing the other side. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if you change your opinion or not, but you at least heard what the other person is saying, and so then we can actually affect change.
Well, Trigger Happy runs from now through April 16th at the Living Room Theater. For showtimes and dates and ticket info, go to thelivingroomkc.com. Ron Simonian is the playwright, and Scott Cordes and Mark Robbins are the actors of Trigger Happy. And thank you all for taking some time.
Thank you, Steve.
Absolutely. Good luck with your run, guys.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll look at how to build a better city block. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. We spoke with Mayor Sly James yesterday about the state of Kansas City, and we previewed two ballot measures on Tuesday's special election ballots. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we'll hear the stories of science gone wrong. Also learn about the National Society dedicated to helping black engineers succeed. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, how do you make a city block more attractive? And how do you make a blighted city block more appealing? That's the mission of the nonprofit Better Block Foundation that helps communities reshape and reactivate their environments. The goal? Growing healthy and vibrant neighborhoods. The organization has spun some of its magic in Kansas City, and here to talk about it ahead of KC Design Week, which begins April 6th, are Jason Roberts. He's founder of the original Better Block Project and chair of the Better Block Foundation. He joins us from Cake Mix Recording down in Dallas. And Jason, good morning.
Good morning.
And Duron Netzel joins us by Skype. He's a project manager for Better Block KC. He's taking time away from a snowboarding trip in Colorado right now to join us. And Duron, thanks so much. Okay. Duron, you've done some of these things in Kansas City. Tell us about one of them. We don't have Duron. Okay, Jason, are you there?
I am here, yes.
Jason, okay, well, let's go with Jason here. I watched one of your TED Talks last night and was amazed by it. This is basically city design for people with great imaginations and short attention spans. Do I see that right?
Yeah, you probably described me pretty well, actually.
That was my sense from the TED Talk, Jason.
That's right.
Yeah. So you go into an area that needs help. Maybe it's depressing, and you inject new life into it by doing things like what?
Well, we meet with the community and we try to ask them, like, what do they feel is missing? What would make these blocks in their neighborhoods destinations? And we found often that things that people love the most or the things that, that exist in the great blocks we love around the world, whether you're in New Orleans or Paris or Mexico City. It's, you know, they want a place to go have, you know, a cup of coffee. They want a place to sit outside. They want shade trees. They want, you know, beautiful kind of sidewalks, you know, with signage and clocks and directories. And so we try to figure out what it is that they feel would make these places more compelling. And then how can we go in and rapidly install the interventions with the community that will change the place temporarily.
And rapidly is an operative word here because why, Jason?
Well, because we feel you have momentum whenever you have a lot of people that come together in a neighborhood and they want to have change. But oftentimes, as you see any kind of change occur, if one or two people that are leading the charge can easily get moved away from something like maybe a child moves to another school, or maybe someone's parent gets ill, or maybe it's an elected official who wants to do things and then all of a sudden is termed out. So we all know we have this time to come together as a community, and that our traditional processes kind of put us through this bureaucratic kind of meat grinder, which can take years, and that gets frustrating, and people have this kind of analysis paralysis, and things just don't happen. Mm-hmm. So how do we you know, my frustration when I was looking at planning documents, I would say, like, okay, this is these things that we're talking about for comprehensive plans for cities are going to make our city great in 20 years.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, how do we make our city great in 20 days?
Mm-hmm. Well, Duron, I want to ask you a question that has nothing to do with a Better Block Foundation, which is, why would you take time away from a snowboarding vacation to spend time here on UpToDate and know how much we appreciate it?
Well, I absolutely love Kansas City, Missouri, and I'm so excited for where this city is headed. And I think Better Block has done an incredible job of sharing a vision with the city and elected officials in the community of what we could be. And obviously, Jason has been that catalytic inspiration to show the city how easily this can be done and how wonderful it is for all users.
If you're looking for inspiration, do yourself a favor. Go to YouTube and put in Jason Roberts and TED Talk, and you'll get a whole 16, 18 minutes worth of it watching him in action. You know, one thing, Duron, that strikes me about the work that you guys do is it doesn't necessarily have to be very expensive. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we've put on several events that have lasted a weekend, and every time our budget has been under $2,000, and most of that money has gone to permitting, traffic control, and insurance. So all the administration tasks, but the labor is all volunteer, and then materials, we often use recycled and reclaimed materials, which have very little cost, and we're able to recycle those onto different events. So we're able to do this for very little money. And again, the only thing that is really drives up the cost is a little bit of red tape that we have to work through.
And Duron, again, so our listeners can get up to speed here with what you're talking about, you say you do these things over the course of a weekend. And the point of that is what? Just to give the neighborhood and city officials some taste of what the potential of a block could be with a little bit of love, right?
Exactly. We have architects that show these beautiful renderings and they look great on paper, but the impact is not really felt until someone is actually able to see that and experience it in person. And so we can see these renderings and we can say, look, this makes this crosswalk, this intersection safer, this lane safer. But when people are actually allowed to walk across that crosswalk or bike in those bike lanes or walk along the street with temporary trees installed, then they really understand how impactful these minor design tweaks can be.
Jason, where did your inspiration for this idea come from? What sparked this?
Well, a couple, actually. Traveling obviously helped a lot, and going to Europe and seeing some of these old world cities that have these beautiful, you know, outdoor cafe seating environments with small local businesses clustered around these areas and wide sidewalks and fountains and public markets and with young people and old people. That was an inspiration. But I'd say also my parents grew up in small towns in Oklahoma with 700 people, and from my mom's town, 2,500 people from my dad's. And I'd go back for Christmas and we'd see their little main streets. And we all have seen these throughout our states. And they would tell me these amazing stories because they were all boarded up at this point. And I guess maybe like a Walmart I got created off of to the highway and really took the energy out of these little downtowns. But they would say, this is where the barber was that we knew. And this was the cafe we all went to. And this is, this is where the Masonic Lodge was. And we had our parades here. And we celebrated our community here. And So it was really kind of hearing about the way things were and then understanding the way I grew up where, you know, I had, you know, a larger kind of chain retail environment. So I had like Little Caesars on the corners and large grocery stores that had people, you know, kids in high school working that didn't really want to be there. It wasn't this passion that was tied to a place. And nobody was celebrating kind of our public life and our shared humanity together in the way that I would hear the stories from my parents.
Yeah. You know, Duron, one thing you often go for is bike lanes. You know, accommodations for bikes have been slow to catch on, you know, here in Kansas City, at least it seems to me, as a guy who rides a bike a lot. Do you see the same thing in other Midwestern cities as you get around, either one of you?
Well, it's something that is only been recently embraced by cities here in the Midwest. I can't think, with the exception of Indianapolis, maybe there isn't really a model city that's really going at this at full steam. But I do think that when you look at our peer cities in the Midwest, we are falling behind.
Mm-hmm. You guys also work with something called protected bike lanes. Jason, what's a protected bike lane?
Well, most bike facilities that we do in the U.S. are just kind of a painted stripe on the ground, or oftentimes they're just a symbol that shows bikes can be here with cars.
Right.
When you create this protected bike lane, you actually buffer this either with like parked cars to the left of the bike lane, or planters, or something like some kind of physical barrier. And what that does, that makes it more. It increases the perception of safety, so you actually get real increases in bike ridership. And one other note I would make too, some of the things that we suffer in the Midwest and in the South with bike infrastructure is. To make bike infrastructure work, first of all, you have to make it irresistible. So creating the protected bikeways really help. But it's also making sure that we have things to bike and walk to. And so having to understand what is the symbiotic relationship between the bike lane and what's at the edge of that, you know, so the cafe, the flower shop, the bookstore, the bike shop, and understanding that the places that this works the best around the world have these environments that you're traversing, some of these beautiful coral reefs of blocks that have these small local businesses clustered together, and you're passing one, and then maybe you go four or five blocks where you're not, and then all of a sudden you hit another one, and then you're not, and then you hit another one, where we have these wide expanses in our environment now that are less compelling and make you feel more vulnerable because you have these wide spaces with wider lanes and cars going faster. And on the edge, you just have two or three businesses. So you'll have like a chain restaurant, maybe that with a drive-through, and you'll have a gas station. And those aren't things that are compelling for people to have a slower experience when they're traversing through a space.
Duron, can you spiff up any block?
Yeah, I think so. Our streets are so wide in Kansas City, and attention to pedestrians as well as bicyclists and even transit users has been so minimal that I really don't think there's a block in Kansas City that we probably couldn't add a little bit improvement to it. If nothing else, a little nature and beautification.
Tell us about one block you've worked on in Kansas City, Duron, that you're especially proud of.
Well, we've had several projects. One of my favorite ones was in Westport on 40th Terrace and Broadway. Mm-hmm. We maintained the current traffic lanes, yet we added parking spots and we added hundreds of square feet of livable space or usable habitable space on Broadway. And so we actually had, during our installation, we had 25 elementary age students practicing karate in what normally would be Broadway Street, but they were protected, or Broadway Boulevard, but they were protected by parked cars and a bike lane.
You know, Jason, it strikes me that what your organization suggests and is all about is that we've all moved too far away from what creativity, I guess, when it comes to our built environment. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's kind of like the analogy of a frog being boiled in water. You know, we've slowly changed the built environment in a way to make it less humane and less of a place that you want to linger in and spend time as a community in. And then I think what's happened is oftentimes we've forgotten what those places look like. That's why when I come back to, we can all drive through that little main street in some small town that's boarded up, and everybody, I think, immediately starts dreaming because they see what's there and they can picture what life was like in those spaces. And I think what these projects do, allow people to not just kind of daydream, but how do we put action to those things? How do we stop talking about what's wrong, and how do we start picking up brooms and grabbing paintbrushes and making a difference now?
And Jason, have you found that you don't have to be a trained architect to do the work that you're doing and come up with ideas that make the built environment a more appealing place to spend time?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I mean, we natively, as humans, know how to make beautiful, great places. We do it all the time. We make our backyard barbecue areas beautiful. We make our patios wonderful and inviting with tables and chairs and shade features and things like that. So I think that we have just gotten away from understanding how to do that within the public realm a bit. So, the nice thing about like a Better Block project is it gives a chance for people to come together and do simple interventions, and then everybody really quickly sees like, oh, you're right. Having these three shade trees here drops the temperature and makes us more comfortable in the area. And then you put this little coffee kiosk, and now I have a cafe set, and then you put a giant chest set over here, and now I want to linger in this space, and now I'm getting to know my community as well. So it's little things like that people start getting, and then they start adding their own little recipes to the mix, and that's when it gets really exciting.
Duron, I haven't seen the giant chess board in Kansas City yet. Is that coming?
Stay tuned.
Oh, really?
we're playing with a couple of different creative ideas, and not sure exactly what they look like, but I think we will definitely be broadening our creativity as we move further down the road.
Can you give us a sense of what areas of town you're working in right now?
Well, we've got a couple different things on tap for 2017. Our most upcoming event, the students at Kansas City Design Center, which is a fifth-year program for architect and urban planning students with Kansas and Kansas State, they are doing an event in conjunction with West Bottoms Heritage Week, and they are activating 11th Street on May 5th through 7th. And so being the West Bottoms there, as you are probably aware, the KCMO is revamping their master bike plan. And mm-hmm. so we have actually been asked to participate in those community meetings. And on May 6th at the Foreign Language Academy, that will be the final community input meeting. And we will actually be doing a small installation there, demonstrated a couple different types of bike lanes. So the community members, before or after providing their input, can come and actually physically experience a couple different types of bicycle infrastructure.
Duron, am I surmising correctly that in a city like Kansas City, or maybe any city that's as old as this one, the number of potential projects is probably longer than you can list on your two arms and your two legs and everything else?
Yeah, probably so. And you know, we're limited with our capacity. We operate solely with volunteers. One very exciting thing that we've got going on, though, is we've received a grant from Planners for Health Initiative through the American Planning Association of Missouri chapter, and they're giving us a grant to buy materials and to set up a lending library, which will collectively organize all of our materials, our processes, and what we've learned. And it will allow the community, it will allow neighborhood groups and other community groups to go access that lending library and teach kind of and guide neighborhoods to do their own better blocks. Mm-hmm. And so our hope is that it won't be us doing all of these, but it will actually be different groups and other civic advocates, people that care about their city, will take the initiative and show what can be done in their neighborhood. Hmm.
Jason, in one of your TED Talks, you made it clear that you're more than willing to break a few rules to show a city what the potential of an area is. You know, building codes be damned, you know, that kind of thing. Has that attitude ever gotten you into trouble?
Yeah, surprisingly, I need to knock on wood. It hasn't, because I guess you see, we do, I mean, we can be pretty vague, flagrant with the way we print off the laws we're breaking and the rules we're breaking and putting in the windows, and we treat it kind of like an art display, and also to be a little tongue-in-cheek, but to make people recognize that a lot of these things we put in place have been put in place for decades ago, and we have no idea why we're still doing them. And really now, with the innovations that exist in technology and the way we are more flexible with the way we build things and build our industries, means that we don't have to be as rigid with our rules. Like a lot of our zoning rules were set in place because we had factories with smokestacks that were in neighborhoods, so we had to create that separation. We're not building structures characters like that on that scale anymore. So we need to revisit a lot of those rules.
You know, Jason, you're also really big on giving projects names like ArtCon and Bike Friendly Oak Cliff. You say that helps to give a project an identity. What do you mean by that?
It's something I learned really. We have a little boutique-y area in our neighborhood of Oak Cliff in Dallas, which has always been stigmatized as the bad part of town. But this is one cluster of buildings that a property owner bought 20 years ago. He just gave it a name. He called it the Bishop Arts District. And it's funny how giving something an identity made people all feel like we had this destination that we could fight for. And so it's kind of this personification of something that allows people to kind of gather and rally around. And when things are nameless, there's not really anything to kind of lead a charge for, and it makes things too vague.
Well, Jason Roberts will present at KC Design Week next Thursday. That's April 6th at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. His presentation is called Creating a Better Block, and there's an admission fee for this one. More information can be found at kcdesignweek.org. Jason Roberts, founder of the original Better Block Project, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Duron Netzel, again, joining us by Skype today. He's the project manager for Better Block KC. Duron, again, thanks for taking some time away from your vacation. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you. It's an honor to be included in this conversation. And Jason, thank you for all the inspiration you've provided, not only for us, but for urbanist and civically engaged minds all around the country.
Oh, thank you so much, Duron. It's inspiring for me to see all these projects take off.
Thanks again, guys. Sure appreciate it. Coming up, Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list. Oh, baby. KCUR contributor Brian McTavish is here to talk about cool stuff to do this weekend. And, hey, welcome.
Hey.
Nice to have you back.
Hey, let's start strong. Let's finish strong. Let's start with beautiful.
Carole King.
Not just you. Beautiful.
Yes.
The Carole King musical.
Wow.
And we're listening to part of the original Broadway cast recording of Carole King, the musical. That's, of course, I Feel the Earth Move, just one of the many hits off of Carole King's 1971
Tapestry. I got a story for you.
Tell me the story.
She was in town a few years ago, and yeah. Steven Steigman and I went on a Sunday night to interview her, and we got going. We were asking her questions. It was when John Kerry was running for president, and I was talking about her life, and she stopped the interview and got very snippy with me and said, I'm here to talk about John Kerry, not about my life. And I said, well, Ms. King, we're going to get to that, but I got some questions, and that was the agreement. And then she sort of gritted her teeth, and we went on.
Well, it sounds like a Battle of the Titans there. My gosh.
Something like
that. Toe-to-toe with Carole.
Yes, but it was fun to be with her, though, nonetheless.
I think you just blew me out of the water.
Yeah,
I don't think I ever did that with Carole King or anything, except appreciate her intensely for many, many years.
Yeah.
This is the Tony Award-winning show, 2014 show, still playing, I dare say, on Broadway, about the life and career of singer-songwriter Carole King. But let's delve down into that. By the way, on stage today through Sunday at the Music Hall, let's delve down before she was the famous singer-songwriter on that groovy album cover in 1971. She was a behind-the-scenes, very successful songwriter. She started out as a teenager writing for teenagers. The Drifters song, Some Kind of Wonderful?
Yeah.
That's her, 1959. She goes downtown and talks to Donnie Kirshner. This is Donnie before he was Don Kirshner.
Huh.
Do you recall Don Kirshner's rock concert?
Yeah, sure.
Syndicated
sure.
television show in the 70s? Okay.
Yeah.
So before all of that happened and his hairline began to recede, he was called the man with the golden ear, right, in New York City music publishing. So she sold her first song to him. He said, keep them coming. She sure did, most of them with the man who would eventually be her husband of 10 or more years, Jerry Goffin, songs like Will You Love Me Tomorrow by the Shirelles, or the Chiffons' One Fine Day, or Little Ava's The Locomotion, or even, get this, you didn't know this, and if you did, pretend you didn't, The Monkees' Pleasant Valley Sunday.
Oh, no kidding.
That's
no kidding.
Her tune. So this show intertwines her showbiz career, her personal life, which was tumultuous at times, oldies but goodies, out the wazoo. Go see this show, Beautiful, the Carole King musical at the Music Hall. Thank you.
This is not Carole King.
Well, it could be.
We've gone down the scale here.
I wonder what the Paragon Ragtime Orchestra thinks of John Kerry.
I don't know.
We'll never know. We might know. Have them on the show sometime. Yes. That's actually a little ragtime ditty called George M. Cohan's Rag by, yes, the Paragon Ragtime Orchestra. That's the acclaimed ragtime band, 11 members all, who will be presenting You're a Grand Old Rag, George M. Cohan's Broadway. That's a special program they do. They'll do it at 1 in the afternoon and 8 in the evening on Friday. The 1 o'clock show is actually a bargain. It's an abbreviated performance. It's only $6 to get in versus 20 on the Friday night show. Where is this? The Polsky Theater at the Carlson Center at Johnson County Community College. So go here, give my regards to Broadway in a ragtime way. George M. Cohan, he would take bits and pieces of popular music at the turn of the 20th century, right?
Yes.
He would turn, he would borrow and sample, and he was a smart guy, and he would infuse some of his big songs with ragtime
vibes.
You're
on fire today. You're just on fire.
I'm actually very hot to the touch.
You came in here locked and loaded.
No, I think you should, yes, you should absolutely appreciate that.
Be sure to see Brian, 7 old things to do in Kansas City this weekend at kcur.org. What do we have?
We're
here?
Not going to stop now. It's the Wild West Vintage Antique Market and Garden Show.
Wow.
Why the Wild West Vintage Antique Market and Garden Show? Because it's in the West Bottoms. That's why.
There you go.
That's all they needed. It's a gathering of local and regional vendors offering, quote, vintage.
They're reaching.
Well, but for a change, I'm not reaching. They're reaching. Local and regional vendors will be there all day Friday and all day Saturday at Hale Arena at the American Oil Complex offering, quote, vintage, shabby, repurposed, antique,
shabby,
jewelry, garden. I know, shabby. You know, things.
That's the word they're using.
That's the word they're using. I mean, I recall when shabby was derogatory. But anyway.
It's hip now, I guess.
It's super hip. So, you know, for your trendy perusal in the West Bottoms, ultra fast, I got to share this with you. It's not even a real story. You never know what you're going to find at these things. A few years ago, 20-like years ago, I found an exterior window to an old mansion. 30 or 40 bucks later, it was hanging in my house. Found art. An exterior window, cracked peeling paint.
So you would have an eye for that. Because you go deep.
I had a wall for that.
Yes.
Yeah, an eye and a wall. And together. Woo, I'm telling you.
Okay. We are just all over the map today. That's Mothership. Mothership.
Oh, I think I've
never heard of Mothership.
I think you're going with the flow on me, or with me. Okay, it's Mothership. It's
Mothership.
It's the brother act from Dallas that explores and does other things with 1970s influenced hard rock, original music.
Goodness.
But the strains of Black Sabbath and UFO and Iron Maiden and ZZ Top and wait for it, Molly Hatchet. It's all in there somewhere.
I haven't thought about Molly Hatchet in a long time.
Well, I know, me neither, and for good reason probably. But you got to go give them a chance. It's Mothership, 8 o'clock, Sunday night at the Riot Room.
You're just almost out of breath. You're going so
fast.
No,
I got plenty of breath. We got one more golden item here.
Yes.
And maybe more than one.
Okay.
Shall we try it?
Last thing.
Okay, maybe.
Coming up.
Maybe.
And finally today.
Yes, yes, Jackie, hit that ball. Satchel Paige's mellow, so is Campanella. Newcomb and Dobin too.
Oh, I like that.
Well, yeah, Jackie Robinson.
Let's talk Negro Leagues baseball.
Let's talk it. Let's talk Baseball Book Notes Book Festival. This is an event actually co-presented by Park. Is it Park University or Park College? You tell me, host with the most.
Park College.
Very good.
University.
That's why you're in that chair.
I switched. I went to university.
Ah. Yeah. It's the Baseball Book Notes Book Festival, where visiting authors of national renown will arrive to discuss their fascinating research into Negro Leagues baseball and Major League Baseball players and coaches of renown. It's a day-long event. Jackie will be touched on, as well as a guy named Ted Strong Jr., who was not only a Negro Leagues All-Star, he was an original Harlem Globetrotter.
No kidding.
And Leo DeRocher, who was Jackie's first manager for the Brooklyn Dodgers.
No kidding.
Some time will be devoted to Leo's memory. 9:30 to 4 Saturday, Negro Leagues Baseball
Sounds
Museum.
Sounds like fun.
And I am now officially sort of out of breath.
That's Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, my friend.
You can follow us on Twitter at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, stories of science gone wrong, and learn about the society that's helping black engineers succeed. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tadakoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.